This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says that Israel has accepted a proposal to bridge differences, holding up a ceasefire and hostage agreement in Gaza, and call for Hamas to do the exact same thing, without saying whether the latest draft has addressed concerns cited by the military group.
Now, what the challenge is, besides Hamas agreeing to the bridging proposal, is to make sure that there are clear understandings on how the different parties are going to make good on their commitments.
Blinken spoke after holding a 2.5-hour meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Monday, and Blinken is expected to travel to Egypt and Qatar on Tuesday. Blinken did not say whether the latest proposal addresses Israel's demands for control over two strategic corridors inside Gaza. Ukrainian local authorities on Monday ordered families with children to urgently evacuate Pokrovsk, an eastern city Russian troops have been pushing towards for months.
Pokrov's direction in the Donetsk region is currently the toughest point at the Ukrainian front line on the territory of Ukraine. And General Sirsky, who is reporting every day to President Zelensky and to the public about this, he's saying that situation is getting worse and situation is getting tougher for Ukrainian forces to keep the defense line. So Russian forces have advanced there.
Reporter Anna Shinnikova on VOA Flashpoint. Kenya's new finance minister says some of the proposed taxes that led to weeks of deadly protests earlier this year will be reintroduced through a tax amendment bill as the country struggles to find revenue to pay off debts to lenders, including the World Bank, International Monetary Fund, and China. This is VOA News. The United States envoy for Sudan, Tom Perriello, said on Monday peace talks were in progress in Switzerland, days after the announcement of the reopening of the country's Adri crossing with Chad.
This model's working. We are actively moving forward in conversation with the army and with the rapid support forces.
Sudan's sovereign council said late last week it would allow the use of Adri port crossing with Chad for 3 months, a move long awaited by aid agencies seeking to send aid into areas of the Darfur region that are threatened with famine. Global monitors say more than 6 million people have faced food insecurity across Darfur, which is mostly controlled by the RSF, the army's rival, in a 16-month war, and famine has taken hold in North Darfur's Zamzam camp. Dozens of protesters broke through a security fence near the site of the Democratic National Convention on its opening day as thousands took to the streets to voice their opposition to the war in Gaza. Families with babies and strollers, students, elected leaders, and others holding up signs and flags joined the march Monday to the United Center, where the convention is being held, and called for a ceasefire in the Israel-Hamas war. As a larger group marched peacefully, a few dozen who broke away tore down pieces of security fence. Several protesters who had managed to get through the fence were detained and handcuffed by officers. The Democratic Republic of Congo hopes to receive its first doses of an mpox vaccine next week, following promises from Japan and the United States to help fight its outbreak. Reuters correspondent Christy Kilburn.
Their arrival would help address a huge inequity that left African countries with no access to the two shots used in a 2022 outbreak, while the vaccines were widely available in Europe and the U.S. Global vaccine group Gavi said last week it had up to $500 million to spend on getting shots to impacted countries. The DRC's health minister said, quote, Gavi has offered to make the vaccines available, and we agreed. The World Health Organization declared mpox a global public health emergency last week for the second time in 2 years, as new variant clade 1B spread rapidly in Africa.
That's Reuters correspondent Christy Kilburn. Russian leader Vladimir Putin has held talks with his Azerbaijani counterpart as part of a two-day trip to secure Moscow's under-pressure trade routes and shore up ties in the south. Business links were high on the agenda as Putin and his president met in the Azerbaijani capital on Monday. Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa. From the Voice of America, I'm James Barton in Washington. Today is Tuesday, August 20th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. The Democratic Party National Convention has begun in the Midwestern city of Chicago.
Looking out at everyone tonight, I see the beauty of our great nation. And this November, we will come together and declare with one voice, as one people, we are moving forward.
We'll have live commentary and analysis from the convention floor. A Liberian delegation has met with the United Nations in New York on establishing a war and economic crimes court in Liberia. The UN says more than 200 humanitarian aid workers were killed in 2023. Ghana's ruling New Patriotic Party unveils a manifesto ahead of the December 2024 general election.
The manifesto somehow departs from the current administration of the New Patriotic Party. That means that there are a lot of issues, there are a lot of programs that this current government is embarking on that is departed by the vice president as the flag bearer of the New Patriotic Party.
Tech innovations offer hope for Africa's overburdened healthcare system. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The Democratic Party National Convention began yesterday in the Midwestern city of Chicago. The party's presidential nominee, Vice President Kamala Harris, and her running mate, Tim Walz, are expected to speak later in the week to outline their vision for the country and how they plan to defeat former President Donald Trump in November. President Joe Biden was expected to speak also last night. Joining us live from Chicago is VOA's Carol Van Dam. Good morning to you, Carol.
Hi, James.
Well, thank you very much again, Carol, for joining us. How would you describe the day so far, one of the convention?
Well, it took a while, to be quite honest, for the delegates to trickle on in. And then it began to be a steady stream about 2 hours before the official speeches began. And by the time it was about an hour ago, I would say, an hour and a half ago, this whole arena, and it's a big arena, was completely jam-packed. And now it's just wall-to-wall, shoulder-to-shoulder people on the floor waiting for President Joe Biden to speak. His good friend, his longtime friend, Senator Chris Coons from Delaware, is speaking right now.
One of the objectives of the convention, Carol, is to reintroduce Vice President Kamala Harris to the American people. How do you think the different speakers did in introducing her?
Oh, it was pretty amazing tonight. She had people from all different walks of life talking tonight in very emotional and rousing speeches, and some of them were quite disturbing, too. Just a few minutes ago, there were a young couple who spoke about how they lost their child when the woman was pregnant with this child, and she couldn't get health care from emergency doctors because it would have been an abortion. When her life became at risk and her temperature spiked, that's only when she was allowed a standard abortion. Then there was another young woman who spoke by herself after that and talked about how she was raped by her stepfather and became pregnant at age. Couldn't imagine just how shocking and horrible that event for her. And she talked about how one in three women in this country cannot get an abortion under the current laws because of the overturning of Roe v. Wade. So that was pretty stark and amazing. But I would say that the most rousing speech and who got the biggest applause and sustained applause was Hillary Rodham Clinton, the former Secretary of State, former presidential candidate who was working in the Obama administration and also former First Lady.
So, Carol, what's on the agenda for today, Tuesday?
Well, speaking of Hillary Rodham Clinton, we're going to hear from her husband, former President Bill Clinton. We're also going to hear, the rest of this week, we're going to hear from other former presidents, Barack Obama and his wife, Michelle, and a lot of stars. And there was a few stars tonight that were on the stage. There was many, many senators and congressmen who are quite famous in their own right, including Jamie Raskin of Maryland, who led the inquiry into the President Trump, former President Trump, who, of course, is the Republican nominee. And it just was people were very roused by his speech as well.
Carol, thank you very much again for joining us live. Thank you very much.
My pleasure, James.
Viewers, Carol Van Dan speaking with us live from Chicago at the Democratic National Convention. Earlier, Vice President Kamala Harris made a brief appearance at the convention.
And for all you will continue to do, we are forever grateful to you. Thank you, Joe. Looking out at everyone tonight, I see the beauty of our great nation, people from every corner of our country and every walk of life are here, united by our shared vision for the future of our country. And this November, we will come together and declare with one voice, as one people, we are moving forward. Guided by our love of country, knowing we all have so much more in common than what separates us, let us fight for the ideals we hold dear, and let us always remember when we fight, we win. God bless you. God bless the United States of America.
Vice President Kamala Harris speaking briefly Monday night at the Democratic Party National Convention in Chicago. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, August 20th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. In Ghana, the governing New Patriotic Party, the NPP, has unveiled its manifesto ahead of the coming December general election. The document detailed a series of policy proposals that the incumbent vice president and NPP's presidential candidate, Mahamudu Bawumia, plans to implement. For more on the manifesto and the latest developments, VOA's Peter Clotty reached political scientist Dr. Isaac Owusu.
One thing that I noticed as far as this program is concerned is that the manifesto somehow departs from the current administration of the New Patriotic Party. That means that there are a lot of issues, there are a lot of programs that this current government is embarking on that is departed by the vice president as the flag bearer of the New Patriotic Party. For instance, the current government, through cabinet and through parliament, enacted the e-levy, which was a very difficult one for the government, but eventually it went through. However, the vice president or the flag bearer of the party is saying that when it comes in, he will abolish it.
But Dr. Owusu, this is an interesting dynamic because you have a government in place, the same party in place, a vice president who is now advocating basically for change in the same administration. Isn't it interesting?
Yeah, that tells you two things. One, either he doesn't support the e-levy policy or they have analyzed that the policy has not been successful as expected. And consequently, they decided that they will go and they will have it departed from that policy. That's number one. There's another one. Issue about Galamsey. You know, Galamsey or small scale money has been a very big problem for the incumbent government. However, he has a different approach towards that. He is saying that when he comes, he will expand the Galamsey business and regularize and legalize it. So, and even open a bank whereby they'll be able to take loans and credit from the bank, so that they'll be able to expand their business and do it and get it regulated well in the public space.
Talking about the manifesto, one issue that a lot of people in Ghana have talked about is the issue of the economy, where ardent supporters think that things have become a little bit difficult. As an economist who promised Ghanaians to lift up the living standards of Ghanaians, what is the strategy here with this new manifesto to do just that?
The economy has several means of contributing to strengthen the economy. One of them, we talk about the fact that Ghana will expand the gold for oil program. And gold for oil program is that the gold that will be extracted in this country will be paid for in cedis, and then we will use that gold to buy oil. So that instead of paying dollars to the importers of oil, they rather have gold in exchange. Number two, it was also going to ensure that a lot of resources will pop into the extractive industry, whereby more gold will be extracted in this country. Because according to the estimation, I think Ghana has over 3 trillion ounces of gold. So he has a plan of making sure that some of this extraction is being done, like the way we have the lithium also done. Beyond that also, he is talking about huge opportunity to the private sector, whereby people can get employment. When a lot of people have employment, I think it will bring some form of relief to the Ghanaian people as well. And therefore, instead of buying outright a lot of things, instead of building a lot of infrastructure, they rather lease from there so that to create space for the central government to undertake other essential expenditure that they're supposed to engage in.
Political scientist Isaac Owusu of Ghana was speaking with viewers Peter Clotty. Liberian President Joseph Boakai this month announced the formation of a committee to reconstitute the leadership of the Office of War and Economic Crimes Court to pursue justice for victims of the country's civil war. A senior Liberian delegation met with the United Nations yesterday Monday, in New York. Adama Dempster is the lead campaigner for human rights and justice in Liberia and a member of the delegation. He tells me the delegation was well received at the UN.
So by matter of fact, to address the culture of impunity, to establish a war crimes court, which has to do with dealing with violations of human rights and international humanitarian law, a force directly within the international community's corridor, or I would say in their hand when it comes to a state party that is moving towards addressing the culture of impunity. So automatically, as a state party like Growth Fund itself, is to present a political will to the international community that indeed we are ready to take up the responsibility to bring a closure to the widespread atrocities that were committed in Liberia. So by virtue of that, this meeting today in New York, which I was privileged to share the panel with the Foreign Minister of the Republic of Liberia and the Justice Minister and Attorney General of the Republic of Liberia, was basically to present to the UN Peacebuilding Commission a convincing proposal why Liberia should be supported, Liberia should be assisted technically, financially, to establish a World Economic Crimes Court.
What was the reception to this presentation that was made?
Today, I can tell you that there was so much energy in the room. The reception, the responses from all of the most of the countries that attended, the United Kingdom, the United States, we're talking about the EU, we're talking about Germany, we even coming back to even our own African continent, they all have expressed support for Liberia because this has been long overdue that over 250,000 people died. There have been no accountability. So to address transitional justice process, that is the root cause of the conflict, has to be investigated. It has to be decided so that the country can bring a closure. So positively, the UN response today, I can say, is in the right direction. There is a political, diplomatic, consent towards helping Liberia to be able to raise the necessary support that will establish the War and Economic Crimes Court.
The idea of this War and Economic Crimes Court in Liberia, is this a general consensus, or this is being pushed by one group of people who are interested in justice?
So I don't want to come up with a foregone conclusion, but I would tell you that the atrocities that were committed in Liberia, they are overwhelming. And the fact that this broke the fabric of the country apart, and the culture of impunity have dominated the lifestyle of Liberia, the advocacy and campaign for the establishment of a war crimes court have been decades long. It's just not happening maybe in 1 or 2 years. If you go back to the release of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission report in 2009, only from the phase of Madam Ellen Johnson Sirleaf administration coming to President George Weah, this advocacy has resonated. So it's just not a group of people who want to see a war crimes court. But this is the advocacy that the Liberian people, victims and survivors of the Civil War, have been yearning to see whether there will be any form of accountability, reparation, that Liberia will move towards when it comes to erasing the echoes of the Civil War. So it is not just one group of people, not just civil society, not just the human rights community.
Adama Dempster is the lead campaigner for human rights and justice in Liberia. He was speaking with us from New York City. According to the United Nations, there is only one doctor for every 5,000 people in Africa, a continent that bears 25% of the global disease burden. But with the number of mobile phone users on the rise, some technology innovations are helping to bridge the doctor-patient gap and expand healthcare coverage. Mohammed Yusuf reports.
Overcrowding in African hospitals is blamed on the scarcity of health facilities and doctors, especially in rural areas. Experts say technological innovations can help Africa solve some of these problems. Yao Asamoah is the head of MedPharma Care in Ghana. The company has developed an app that allows patients to connect face-to-face online with doctors and pharmacists so they can get medicine in their homes. He says their system improves patients' experience when seeking healthcare services.
So that's where MedPharma basically comes in, to see how we can digitize the whole idea of healthcare, bring in telemedicine, make it possible for people to either have e-consultation, e-prescription, get their medicines delivered to them wherever they are, either at the office or at home, do their diagnostics remotely.
The World Health Organization says 57 countries are suffering from a critical shortage of health personnel, 36 of them in Africa. The 2001 Abuja Declaration requires that African Union countries allocate 15% of their annual budgets to health, a requirement most governments have yet to fulfill. Funding and infrastructure issues have blocked millions of Africans' access to quality health care. But experts say digital tools could improve access to services in hard-to-reach areas that lack doctors. Muntaga Keita is a Guinean-born businessman who invented 3 portable diagnostic terminals which can monitor a patient's temperature, blood pressure, heart function, and conduct ultrasounds.
The benefit of that is the ease it brings to doctors and to patients. Instead of clogging hospitals, now the doctors can just get, or nurses, to the patients. They collect all the data, send the data in a very secured manner into the hospital so people can analyze and then bring it back to the patient.
Keita has so far deployed 40 kits to different hospitals in Guinea. According to Keita, the diagnostic terminals have attracted the attention of other countries like Gabon, which has requested 6 machines. He's in talks with the governments of Burkina Faso, Ivory Coast and Senegal to supply the kits there. Keita says his technology can help solve the doctor-to-patient ratio problem and save patients money.
With this kind of technology, all the vital signs of any patient forwarded in a very secure manner, also encrypted to a specialist who is in Tunisia, who is in Kenya, who is in, Tokyo or in Paris, to interpret and bring the result. Then we know if we have to spend that 45,000 euros to evacuate, or if we can locally cure the person.
Since the COVID-19 pandemic, telemedicine has grown expansively and gained attention in Africa. Asamoah says telemedicine provides access to many doctors who specialize in different diseases, easing the burden on healthcare facilities.
But in a normal circumstance, if you went to a clinic in Ghana, you wanted to talk to a specialized consultant, you might probably not get, because either they don't have, they haven't booked you, or they are just not available. But telemedicine makes it possible. You can make your appointment and you can basically talk to any doctors.
Mark Kinsey and Company, a global management consulting firm, analyzed the impact of digital health tools in Kenya, Nigeria and South Africa, and found that the tools could reduce the continent's total healthcare costs by 15% by 2030. Mohammed Yusuf, VOA News, Nairobi.
At least 280 humanitarian aid workers were killed last year around the world. This is according to the United Nations, which says more than half of the workers died during the Israel war against Hamas in Gaza. Maureen Odhiambo reports.
The United Nations says the high number represents a 137% increase compared to the year 2022. The Office of the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs projects that 2024 may be even more deadly. The Aid Workers Security Database indicates that as of August 7th, at least 172 aid workers have been killed globally. The agency says extreme levels of violence in Sudan and South Sudan contributed to the catastrophic death toll both in 2023 and 2024. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres says that aid workers, mostly national staff serving their own communities, are facing violence.
2023 was the deadliest year on record for humanitarian personnel in Gaza, in Sudan, and many other places. Humanitarian workers are being attacked, killed, injured, and abducted alongside the civilians they support. Disinformation campaigns spread lies that cost lives. International humanitarian law, the law that protects civilians during wartime, is being ignored and trampled. A climate of impunity means perpetrators do not fear justice. This is a failure of humanity, responsibility, and leadership.
More than 140 million people received life-saving aid from UN humanitarian aid workers last year. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, 6 humanitarian aid workers have been killed and 11 others kidnapped between January and June this year. At the same time, several humanitarian workers continue to be detained in Yemen, with the UN calling for their immediate release. Hans Grunberg is the special envoy of the Secretary General for Yemen on the situation in the Middle East.
Dozens of men and women, among which 13 UN personnel, including one of my own staff members, are still being detained in unknown locations. These detentions are in addition to OHCHR and UNESCO staff who have been detained.
We now join the Democratic Party convention in Chicago, where President Joe Biden is about to speak.
My fellow Democrats, my fellow Americans, nearly 4 years ago, in winter, on the steps of the Capitol, on a cold January day, I raised my right hand and I swore an oath to you and to God to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution, and to faithfully execute the office of the President of the United States. In front of me was the city surrounded by the National Guard. Behind me, a Capitol just 2 weeks before had been overrun by a violent mob. But I knew then, from the bottom of my heart, that I knew now, there is no place in America for political violence. None. You cannot say you love your country only when you win. In that moment, I wasn't looking to the past. I was looking to the future. I spoke of the work at hand, the moment we had to meet. It was, as I told you then, a winter of peril and possibility. Of peril and possibility. We're in the grip of a once-in-a-century pandemic, historic joblessness, a call for racial justice long overdue, clear and present threats to our very democracy. Thank you. And yet I believe then, and I believe now, the progress was and is possible. Justice is achievable.
That was President Joe Biden introducing himself, and was about to speak at the Democratic Party convention. And that's it for this Tuesday, August 20th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your morning with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I am James Botte in Washington.